The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated December 21/December 28, 2020. It features the usual red border around the cover with Time in large block letters in red. And at the top is the heading Person of the Year in white lettering against a black background. There are two people sharing the Person of the Year on Time's cover this time. They do not look like photographs to me, or maybe they're photoshopped. They look like oil paintings superimposed as a photographic illustration on the cover. And the people of the year, are Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, Changing America's Story. Biden's headshot is in front with a partial profile, as is Harris's right alongside him. He's Caucasian with silvery white hair, bright blue eyes, and smiling slightly. White shirt, blue collar is about all we can see of his top posture, and a red and white, almost a candy cane striped tie. Kamala Harris is a person of color. She has pale, creamy coffee-colored skin, dark hair with a slight brush over the portion of her forehead that's visible. She has brown eyes. She has a bit of lip rouge on, and she is not really smiling, but she certainly has a neutral rather than a sad face. She's wearing black, I think, either black or midnight blue, with a tiny flag lapel pin, which may indicate her station as a senator, and she's wearing a single strand of pearls. Neither's looking into the camera. Both are in partial profile, looking askance. The first page I shall read to you is titled 2020, the Year in Firsts and Lasts. This is dated chronologically throughout the year. February 9, Bong Joon-ho's biting class satire, Parasite, is the first foreign language film to win Best Picture at the 2020 Oscars. March 18, the Eurovision Song Contest is canceled for the first time in the international music competition's 64-year history over coronavirus concerns. April 12, with sports worldwide on pause because of the pandemic, Taiwan's Chinese Professional Baseball League is the first major professional sports organization to begin its 2020 season. Backtracking here to another March date. March 9, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle attend their last public engagement as working members of the British royal family. Backtracking to January, this is not in chronological order, so I'm skipping about to make it so. January 31, the last day the UK remains a member of the European Union ahead of an 11-month Brexit transition period. April 8, last day of an 11-week lockdown in Wuhan, China, the original epicenter of the COVID-19 pandemic. May 26, Costa Rica becomes the first Central American country to legalize same-sex marriage. June 12, ABC confirms Matt James as the first black man cast as The Bachelor, ahead of the show's 25th season. July 10, the last day Istanbul's Hagia Sophia is designated as a museum, after 85 years following a Turkish court's ruling that reverts its status to that of a mosque. August 14, the Pentagon announces a task force to analyze the nature and origins of UFOs, its first official acknowledgement of such active investigative work. August 25, the World Health Organization declares Africa free of wild polio for the first time. September 16, Japan's longest-serving Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, serves his last day in office after resigning August 28. October 16, Coca-Cola announces plans to discontinue production of Tab, its first diet soda, by the end of 2020. October 26, NASA confirms the first discovery of water molecules on the moon's surface. November 16, the day Iota, or Iota, the last named storm of the 2020 Atlantic hurricane season, reaches Category 5 status, also the first time 30 named storms form in the Atlantic in a single year. November 20, Pfizer is the first COVID-19 vaccine maker to seek FDA authorization, closely followed by Moderna and AstraZeneca. December 1, last day the streaming service Quibi is operational, folding just 8 months after its much-touted launch. And December 25, the scheduled air date for the last Jeopardy episode featuring its 37-season host, Alex Trebek, who died November 8. 2020, The Year in Heroes by Amy Gunia. Australia's volunteer firefighters risked everything to keep their country safe in November 2019. Luke Summerscales and Jessica Jacobs were in a remote mountain range of New South Wales fighting some of the worst bushfires on record in Australia when another disaster struck. A fellow firefighter collapsed from a heart attack. The nearest ambulance was more than an hour away, and the terrain was too steep for a rescue helicopter to land. So the pair started doing CPR on 53-year-old John Kennedy. Fires burning around them, Summerscales and Jacobs struggled to get defibrillator pads to stick to Kennedy's chest. They performed CPR for 45 minutes before Kennedy was able to breathe on his own. "We lost him three times, but we got him back every time," Jacobs says. "We're so lucky to have been able to really make a difference." In November 2020, the Country Fire Authority, a fire management organization, recognized their actions by giving them both Chief Officer Commendation Awards, but Summerscales and Jacobs are not professional firefighters, they are volunteers. Summerscales builds houses for a living, Jacobs works as a university lab technician. Starting in late 2019, as record fires raged across their nation during its summer season, they joined tens of thousands of Australians who set aside their usual lives to help stop the spread of the blazes. As climate change heightens both the frequency and intensity of bushfires, firefighters are being tested to new extremes. Australia is unusually reliant on volunteer labor in the state of New South Wales, which suffered some of the country's most severe fires during the 2019-2020 bushfire season. Close to 90% of the men and women fighting fires were volunteers. It's been this way for more than a century in Australia, with ordinary citizens working together to protect the land. But last year especially, their service came with incredible sacrifice. They gave up the holidays with their families, took time off work, lost income to fight infernos that burned for several months in 2019 and early 2020. Three volunteer firefighters lost their lives. 2019 was Australia's hottest and driest on record, and the resulting fires all but exhausted the men and women constantly called to battle them. Peter Holding, 66, who has been a volunteer firefighter for 43 years, says he's never seen anything as severe as last summer's bushfire season, a devastating period now known as the Black Summer. There's going to have to be some very serious effort put into reducing emissions if we're going to stop this from getting any worse, he says. Still, as Australia's fire season intensifies in late 2020, its volunteer firefighters are preparing to do battle again. It's about the impact we have on the community and the people we help, Summer Scales says. It is that feeling that you made a difference. There's a photo here. The caption reads, Firefighters on the outskirts of Bredebow, New South Wales, Australia, February 1. It is red. There are four people walking into and beside an inferno. Their truck, Fire Rescue Truck 399, is parked on a roadway. The four individuals are dragging hoses along that roadway. They're clothed in some type of firefighting gear. I can't tell if they're bright yellow or bright orange or bright red coats with the same color helmets, because everything is reflected from this inferno of bright orange red, like that of the brightest sunset you may have known. Fires are creeping along one edge of the roadway, and the other side of the roadway is already destroyed, with trees looming in the background. Continuing 2020, the year in heroes. This is by Abigail Abrams. The pastors who transformed their church to support their community. Pastor Rashorna Fitzpatrick and her husband, Bishop Derek Fitzpatrick, are used to public service, having spent the past two decades leading Stone Temple Missionary Baptist Church on Chicago's west side. But their efforts intensified this year as the couple transformed their church into a hub of community outreach, a food bank, a distributor of cleaning supplies, a stage for self-expression, and more. In April, with members of their congregation and neighborhood among the millions of Americans out of work, the couple began giving out roughly 300 food boxes a week to those in need. Produce from the church's community garden also filled the Love Fridge, an outdoor refrigerator near the church stocked with free food. When funds for their food box initiative ran out, they partnered with the Urban Growers Collective, a local black and women-led nonprofit farm, to source fresh produce. The Fitzpatricks also launched a Soup for the Soul program, where community members can pick up hot soup made by local chefs every Monday. I really do believe we are our brother's keeper, Rashorna says. The church has also provided the local community with at least 20,000 masks, as well as hand sanitizer and other supplies. This summer, the Fitzpatricks hosted socially distanced outdoor services, and in the fall built an outdoor stage where members of the community put on performances and share stories. People are more easily able to talk about the need, Derek says, of the pandemic's impact on long disenfranchised community members. The Fitzpatricks know it's been a difficult year, but say they feel more connected than ever. I live to make sure that people are blessed, says Rashorna. Here's a small inset photo of the Fitzpatricks. She's petite, wearing an ivory-colored outfit with a mask, rose-colored. He's taller. Cannot see his face because he's wearing a baseball cap. It appears that he has sunglasses, and he's wearing a light blue mask, wearing a purple shirt and dark slacks. They're in an urban setting. There are trees in the background and several buildings. One looks like a single-story garage and another a multi-story dwelling. The food stall owners who would not let anyone go hungry, this is again by AG, whoever that is, as restaurants around the world took huge hits during COVID-19 lockdowns, two food stall owners in Singapore remained busier than ever. When the Southeast Asian city-state went into a circuit-breaker lockdown in April to stop the spread of the coronavirus, Jason Chua and Hong Zhen Long, who co-own Bang Hu Cooks in the popular Hong Lim Market and Food Center, took to delivering food free of charge to anyone who could not afford it. Chua says the idea was prompted by a friend who told him about seeing an elderly man begging for money in a coffee shop. The friend asked Chua if they could do something to help. Just hours later, Chua and Hung shared a message on the Bang Hu Cooks Instagram page, telling Singaporeans to reach out if they needed a free meal, with a promise to not ask any questions. They were soon inundated with requests. Chua and Hung put up roughly $6,000 of their personal funds for the cause, while Chua's friend, the one who'd raised the initial concern about food access during the pandemic, donated $5,000 more. From April to June, when lockdown measures eased, Chua estimates they gave away around 2,500 meals, each consisting of a bowl of rice, a protein, and two vegetables. Life has largely returned to normal in Singapore, where COVID-19 is currently under control. Bang Hu Cooks has stopped its deliveries, and Chua and Hung have shuttered the food stall to focus on a new endeavor, opening a restaurant. But their work during lockdown gave new meaning to goodwill, which accountants, when determining the full value of a business, describe as an intangible asset. Not that this was about business. I don't want to see kids or families go hungry, Chua said. The Man Who Made a Paper Route, A Lifeline, by Madeline Carlisle. In mid-March, terrified of catching COVID-19, Phyllis Ross, 88, asked her newspaper delivery man if he would throw the paper closer to her West Windsor, New Jersey home. Greg Daly was happy to oblige. Days later, Ross's predicament was still on Daly's mind. If Ross could not make it to the sidewalk, how could she possibly buy food? So he called to ask, did she need anything from the grocery store? Ross jumped at the chance and asked if he wouldn't mind also getting food for her neighbor. The request inspired Daly to think of a new delivery service. The following Saturday, he left a note in the newspapers for all 800 houses on his route, offering to drop off goods to anyone in need, free of charge. He had not even made it home before the calls started rolling in. Initially overwhelmed, Daly quickly got to work with the help of his family. They were soon spending 12 hours a day delivering food to senior citizens in need. The family has since supplied more than 140 homes and conducted more than 1,000 grocery runs in the Mercer County area, and they're still going. Other than raising my 3 kids, it's been the most rewarding thing I've done, Daly says. The Neighbor Who Sheltered Those in Need by Josiah Bates. By the way, there's a photo here of the two young men who run the Bang Hu Cooks food stall. They're in their food stall in this photo. They are both young men with dark, short-cropped hair. One's wearing glasses, one's with a dark T-shirt and lots of tattoos on the arm that is visible in the photo, his right arm. The other one's back at food prep area. It looks like he's preparing eggs, although I can't really see. And there's a steam table in the front of the photo. Here's Greg Daly with his mask on, getting out of his vehicle with bags of food, presumably from a supermarket. And the photo that accompanies this last segment is, goodness, a couple of dozen people. They all look young. Most of them are people of color, some Caucasians, some Asians. They're all wearing masks, and they're all huddled, I mean huddled, into a room surrounded by windows. The Neighbor Who Sheltered Those in Need. On June 1, as demonstrators filled the streets of Washington, D.C., to protest the killing of George Floyd, Rahul Dubey was at home, not far from the White House. After a 7 p.m. curfew, he noticed crowds in the street outside. Police had set up barricades, seemingly to trap protesters, and were pepper spraying those who remained. Duby decided to take action. "I open my door and I start yelling, 'Get in,' says Duby, who works in healthcare. All these people were swarming in. Duby estimates he gave 70 protesters refuge, housing them overnight to avoid curfew breaches. People were coughing, crying, strangers pouring milk into strangers' eyes, Duby says. They were sharing information, writing down numbers for bail bondsmen. It was this real camaraderie. Duby claims police officers made several attempts to breach his sanctuary that evening, posing as protesters, trying to get inside, attempting to intercept the pizza delivery he ordered for his house guests. The move to open his door was driven by instinct, Duby says, nearly 6 months later. It's what was needed. Here's the cover story, 2020 Person of the Year, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Joe Biden shares a full-page photo opposite another full-page photo of Kamala Harris. They both look pretty much as they did in the front cover, except they're both smiling broadly, and one does see more of their full frame rather than just the headshots. Biden standing again in his dark blue suit against a red background. Harris again in either her midnight blue or black outfit against a bright blue background. The Choice by Edward Felsenthal. Times Person of the Year over the course of nearly a century has been a measuring stick for where the world is and where it is going. But how to make sense of 2020, a year without measure? A year marked by multiple crises all at once all over the world. A once-in-a-century plague. Brutal racial injustice, glaring inequity, apocalyptic wildfires, democracy under fire. It was a particularly humbling year for the most powerful nation on earth, a wake-up call for those more accustomed to seeing America, despite its flaws, as a beacon for the world. The U.S. has seen by far the most confirmed cases of COVID-19 of any country, and some of the worst fatality rates. The killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Tony McDade, and many more brought about a reckoning with systemic racism, long overdue and extraordinary in scale. Economic inequality deepened. Almost 1 in 8 American adults reported their household did not have enough to eat at some point in November. Devastating fires across the West Coast showed how unprepared we are for climate change. Conflicts over voting tallies and the science of wearing masks showed how divided we are even on basic facts. Joe Biden was elected President of the United States in the midst of an existential debate over what reality we inhabit. Perhaps the only thing Americans agree on right now is that the future of the country is at stake, even as they fiercely disagree about why. Dismissed as out of touch on the left and misrepresented as a socialist from his right, Biden stood his ground near the center and managed to thrive even as the social, digital, and racial landscape around him shifted. With more than 51%, Biden won a higher percentage of the popular vote than any challenger to a presidential incumbent since Franklin Roosevelt in 1932. What I got most criticized for was I said we had to unite America, he told me in a conversation, masks off, 16 feet apart, at his unofficial transition hub in Wilmington, Delaware, December 7. I never came off that message in the primary or in the general election. Whether America can be or even wants to be united is a question he will soon have to face. It's noteworthy that a year after selecting climate activist Greta Thunberg, the youngest person ever named Person of the Year, we moved to one of the oldest in the 78-year-old president-elect. Biden calls himself a bridge to a new generation of leaders, a role he embraced in choosing Kamala Harris, 56, the first woman on a winning presidential ticket, daughter of a Jamaican father and Indian mother. If Donald Trump was a force for disruption and division over the past 4 years, Biden and Harris show where the nation's heading, a blend of ethnicities, lived experiences, and world views that must find a way forward together if the American experiment is to survive. "I will be the first, but I will not be the last," Harris told Time, and that's about legacy. That's about creating a pathway. That's about leaving the door more open than it was when you walked in. Time, from its beginnings, has had a special connection to the presidency as a reflection of America and its role in the world. Every elected president since FDR has at some point during his term been a person of the year, nearly a dozen of those in a presidential election year. This is the first time we've included a vice president. In a year that saw an epic struggle for racial justice and one of the most consequential elections in history, the Biden-Harris partnership sends a powerful message. "The tell of this election," says Harris, "is that regardless of your race, your ethnicity, the language your grandmother speaks, let's move forward, knowing the vast majority of us have more in common than what separates us." The task before the new administration is immense. A pandemic to confront, an economy to fix, a climate crisis to tackle, alliances to rebuild, deep skepticism to overcome, with many Americans dubious about unity with Trump voters, and an opposition party still very much under Trump's sway. How to begin to reach out to, much less lead, the Americans who profess to believe that Donald Trump won the election, I asked Biden. His answer was more or less, "Trust me and trust the American people. You're going to see an awful lot of Republicans in the House and Senate willing to work with me," Biden says. "I think that's what I've done my whole career." This will be the test of the next 4 years. Americans who have not been this divided in more than a century elected two leaders who've bet their success on finding common ground. The odds may be long, but it will be among the most critical chapters in the arduous quest for a more perfect union, for changing the American story, for showing that the forces of empathy are greater than the furies of division, for sharing a vision of healing in a grieving world. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are Time's 2020 Person of the Year. A new section now, Guardians of the Year. Dr. Anthony Fauci and the frontline health workers. Guardians put themselves on the line to defend the ideals sacred to democracy. In 2020, they fought on many fronts. In Washington, Dr. Anthony Fauci led not only the battle against COVID-19, but also the fight for truth, clear, consistent messaging being fundamental to public health. With steadfast integrity, Fauci nudged, elided, and gently corrected a president used to operating in a reality of his own construction, buoyed by the fervent repetition of lies. On the front line against COVID-19, the world's healthcare workers displayed the best of humanity, selflessness, compassion, stamina, courage, while protecting as much of it as they could. By risking their lives every day for the strangers who arrived at their workplace, they made conspicuous a foundational principle of both medicine and democracy, equality. By their example, healthcare workers this year guarded more than lives. The shared experience of watching George Floyd die was proof, if anyone needed, that black lives are still not treated as equal in America. In the wake of Floyd's killing surged a wave of outrage that was harnessed by organizers, both veteran and newly energized, to bring millions to the streets and spotlight the inequities in a world that claims to be far better than it is. The movement for racial justice found its voice in multitudes. A mother in Kenosha delivering her frank report to Joe Biden. A sister in Paris calling for police accountability in her brother's death. If the truth they guard, lived truth, can bolster the structures of the society that emerges from the trauma of this extraordinary year, it might also redeem it. By Carl Vick. A photo here of healthcare workers in their healthcare coverage of clothing. Carrying the load, Dr. Sherry Milton moves a gurney after transferring a COVID-19 patient to ICU at Lincoln Medical Center in the Bronx, April 3, when New York was the U.S. epicenter of the pandemic. Three of them here working on one patient whom is not seen in the photo. Here's Dr. Anthony Fauci, a photo of him, photographed in Bethesda, Maryland, December 4. He's not wearing his glasses. He usually is. He has grayish-white hair combed back from his face. Maybe blue, gray, green eyes. Hard to tell. He's not smiling openly, but he's kind of smiling there. He's got a blue shirt buttoned down and blue and white dotted tie. His arms folded in front of him. His black watch barely visible beneath the cuff of his sleeve. In the face of those who sought to undermine facts, he fought for science, by Alice Park, with reporting by Madeline Roche, London. Most 79-year-olds don't get unsolicited phone calls about brand new job opportunities, but few people of any age have Dr. Anthony Fauci's resume or stamina. When Joe Biden called Fauci December 3 for their first conversation since the election, the president-elect asked him to stay on as director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, a position he's held for 36 years, and to serve as chief medical advisor to the new administration. I said, "Mr. President-elect, of course I will do that. Are you kidding me?" Fauci recalls a day later in an interview with Time. True to form, Fauci, who's guided the U.S. through HIV, H1N1, SARS, MERS, Ebola, and Zika, was immediately on the job. During the 15-minute call, Biden solicited Fauci's advice about what's become a point of contention between public health experts and the ongoing Trump administration, the role of masks in controlling the COVID-19 pandemic. Biden said once he was inaugurated, he planned to announce a 100-day nationwide mask-wearing policy as a way to tamp down the rising wave of coronavirus cases. It is something Fauci's urged, but President Trump never supported. Fauci agreed with the idea, as well as Biden's proposal for limited mask mandates, starting with those who work on and use public transportation, like buses, trains, and subways. He is one of the most universally admired infectious disease experts in the world, Dr. Howard Koh, a professor at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and former Assistant Secretary for Health at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, says of Fauci. For the health of our country and the world right now, he needs to be front and center every day. That might seem like a given during such a public health crisis, but over the past year, experts like Fauci were forced to battle not just a new virus, but also a president who assaulted scientific facts for political gain. Week after week, as Donald Trump commandeered pandemic press briefings and turned to social media, first to downplay the extent of the disease and paint a rosier-than-reality picture of the U.S. response, then to espouse unproven or even dangerous treatments, in quotes, the voices of public health experts became harder to hear. Throughout those weeks, Fauci took every opportunity to keep those voices from going silent, even as his own was turning raspier from his constant media appearances, press briefings, and private meetings with administration health officials. The world watched as Fauci conducted a masterclass in scientific diplomacy, witnessing in real time how his understanding about the virus changed as science tried to keep up with the pandemic, and how he deftly adjusted and refined public health messages as that knowledge grew. We watched as Fauci held live demonstrations on how to stay true to the facts in the face of those who seek to undermine them. In July, after Trump touted hydroxychloroquine as a COVID-19 treatment, Fauci noted no rigorous studies showed the malaria drug was effective against the virus. During a Senate hearing in September, Fauci strongly disagreed with Senator Rand Paul's suggestion that natural herd immunity, achieved by allowing the virus to infect a population so more people can develop immunity, was a reasonable solution to the pandemic. Most U.S. public health experts never entertained this as a viable pandemic control strategy because it's too risky for people's health. You've misconstrued that, Senator, and you've done that repeatedly in the past, Fauci said. He saved his strongest rebuke for a Trump re-election campaign ad, which took something Fauci had said about the work of the coronavirus task force on which he serves to imply that Fauci approved of Trump's pandemic response. Fauci immediately countered the idea that he would endorse any political candidate and said the quotes were taken out of context. I really got pissed off because I am so meticulous about not getting involved in favoring any political group or person or being part of any kind of political thing, he says. As he continued to defend the facts and just the facts, Fauci became a household name, that is spelled F-A-U-C-I. Today he is both a symbol of scientific integrity and a target of frustration, criticism, and even violent threats by those who blame him for the school closures, job losses, and deaths of loved ones from COVID-19. But he is keenly aware that both the hero worship and the scapegoating are a consequence of his becoming a stand-in for the complex fallout of the pandemic. He has continued to oversee the basic research that has now led to an approved drug and two COVID-19 vaccines that could start being distributed to the public by Christmas, which we know is being done. And he does not plan on stepping down anytime soon. I'm not even thinking of walking away from this, Fauci says. You train as an infectious disease person and you're involved in public health like I am. If there's one challenge in your life you cannot walk away from, it is the most impactful pandemic in the last 102 years. Business Person of the Year, Eric Yuan. That's Y-U-A-N. The CEO of Zoom brought an isolated world a little closer together by Andrew R. Chow. When Milo McCabe's daughter was born, he could see her. He could see she had 10 fingers, 10 toes, and dark swirls of hair. He could hear her piercing cry, but he could not make out the color of her eyes, and heartbreakingly, he could not hold her. He was watching over Zoom. McCabe had never considered not being in the delivery room, but in early April he fell ill with COVID-19 and was rushed to a hospital in Southern California. When his wife Roxanne went into labor more than a week later at the same hospital, he was still there, but could barely get out of bed. A video call was the next best thing. They wanted to see each other's faces, record the proceedings, and stay on for hours for free without technical glitches. So they chose Zoom, Z-O-O-M, a platform that they, like most of the world, had barely used previously, but that now seemed to be everywhere. I remember going through contractions and hearing his voice saying, "You're doing good, babe," every few minutes, Roxanne said. I would turn to look at the video on my left as if he was going to go somewhere, but he wasn't going anywhere. They were together for almost 11 hours before Ember Leanne emerged into the world. "It wasn't how I anticipated your coming out party, kid," McCabe says 8 months later, looking down at the daughter in his arms. If the idea of a Zoom birth was shocking to the McCabes, it would have been no less surprising to Eric Yuan. The 50-year-old founder and CEO of Zoom had worked for a decade to build a no-frills, highly functional conferencing platform for businesses. Now it was being used in all sorts of unexpected places, from delivery rooms to grade schools. "We never thought about consumers or K-12 schools when we started planning the year 2020, says Yuan, speaking over Zoom from his home in the Bay Area. He had ordered employees to work from home in early March, but it wasn't until weeks later, around when UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson tweeted a photo of a cabinet meeting over Zoom, that it dawned on Yuan that his company might play a major role in this new virtual world order. Yuan soon found himself serving as the world's relationship liaison, social chair, principal, convention center host, chief security officer, and pallbearer. Despite competition from corporate behemoths like Google, Apple, and Microsoft, Zoom jumped out in front of the video pack, catapulting from 10 million daily meeting participants in December to a staggering 300 million in April. Zoom became a verb and a prefix, a defining syllable of a socially distant era. As his company's valuation soared, Yuan crashed into the Forbes billionaires list. But almost as soon as Zoom became ubiquitous, its vertiginous rise was imperiled. Security flaws left users vulnerable to surveillance and harassment. Its very popularity produced burnout while exposing the gap between white-collar households and those without even internet. Some accused Yuan of being just another complacent big tech guru whose product heightened division and misinformation. Yuan responded with swift course correction and transparency, at least to the security issues, gaining the trust of many critics, and the company's stock has tripled since April. Zoom was named Apple's most downloaded free app of the year. It won the 2020 Video Wars partially because, like its founder, it is flexible, intuitive, and pretense-free. It was adaptable in a year when there was hardly a more vital attribute, and it offered glimpses, promising and ominous alike, of what human connection might look like for years to come. It might be fair to call Zoom a product of young love. In the late 1980s, Eric Yuan, born Yuan Zheng in Ta'an, China, that's T-A-I-apostrophe-A-N, China, was a math and computer science student at Shandong University. The woman who would become his wife attended college 10 hours away. On his way to visit her, Yuan would doze off, dreaming of a way to instantly see her face. Yuan became obsessed with the dot-com boom, but his American dreams were stalled when he was rejected for a visa 8 times. "I was just so frustrated," he says, "but I was going to keep trying until they tell me, don't come here anymore." Yuan was finally granted an H-1 visa in 1997 at the age of 27. He became a U.S. citizen a decade later. He started as a coder at WebEx and soon became integral to building its video conferencing platform. After Cisco bought WebEx in 2007, Dan Scheinman, senior vice president of Cisco Media Solutions Group at the time, and now a member of Zoom's board of directors, remembers learning of Yuan's reputation as demanding, technically gifted, one of the best product people in the world, and incredible in front of customers, he recalls. "It was a bit like we had Mozart, but no one realized it." Yuan's restless energy comes through bright and clear even on Zoom. He shifts from side to side, his sentences rushing out in declarative bursts, his lines of explanation linear and logical, and often predicated on the belief that humanity's inherently good. "The world is fair," he says at one point. "Keep moving forward and focus on the things you can control." It was this confidence that led a few dozen WebEx engineers to decamp with Yuan in 2011 when he announced he'd be leaving the company to start his own video platform. Zoom's software launched in 2013, touting a free basic service along with several paid tiers for different size organizations. While many other startups leaned heavily on free products to induce widespread saturation, Zoom targeted modest school and business networks that would pay for subscriptions year after year. After nearly a decade of steady growth, the company went public in 2019 to considerable fanfare. Unlike other tech IPOs rocking up huge losses like Uber, Lyft, and Slack, Zoom was both debt-free and profitable. And thanks in part to Yuan's oft-repeated emphasis on delivering happiness, Zoom was also one of the highest employee-rated companies to work for, according to surveys from Glassdoor and Comparably. Yuan had carved a reliable lane and was cautious about moving into the consumer market too quickly. In December, our plans were the same as the year before. No big ideas, just keep innovating, he says. Then the pandemic hit, forcing hundreds of millions of people across the world to shelter in place. They doom-scrolled and binged Tiger King. They baked and bought guitars. And in surging numbers, they logged on to Zoom. They used it for birthday parties, family gatherings, workouts, company meetings, happy hours, blind dates. Saturday Night Live returned with Kate McKillen yelling, "Live from Zoom, it's sometime between March and August." New York legalized Zoom marriages to Yuan's delight. From January to April, the company's metric of analyzed meeting minutes jumped 20-fold to more than 2 trillion, while revenue soared 169% compared with the same quarter in 2019. "You feel like your dream is coming true after many years of hard work," Yuan says. "How did a niche platform vault past bigger competitors like Apple, FaceTime, Google, Meet, Cisco and Skype to define the medium? Off the bat, Zoom is free, at least for 40-minute periods. It is strikingly easy to operate. You do not need to download an app, use a specific browser or operating system, or even have an account. The company's cloud-based operation allowed it to scale relatively seamlessly. Virtual backgrounds lend both novelty and privacy. A snowballing effect fueled momentum. The more users signed on to Zoom, wrote trend pieces, created Zoom memes, and saw it being used on TV, the more others gravitated toward the platform. It did not hurt that the once ubiquitous Skype had stagnated as its parent company, Microsoft, prioritized another video platform, Teams, or that young people were already familiar with the platform thanks to its presence in educational institutions. Zoom may have been boosted by its very name, crisp, familiar, and informal. "With positive connotations, I've never seen anything happen so fast," says Carmen Fott, a linguistics professor at Pitzer College in California. "But it's never been the case that everybody needed a word for something all at the same time." Professional sectors were the first to adapt to Zoom en masse. By June, 42% of the U.S. labor force was working from home full-time, according to a Stanford study. Big banking and international businesses turned to Zoom in droves. So did 125,000 K-12 schools, partially because Yuan offered them the platform for free. Zoom also became a lifeline for fostering community at a moment of acute isolation. Sprawling video parties broke out every weekend, including Club Quarantine, a queer virtual Toronto nightclub that blossomed into an international phenomenon. On Saturday night, stars like Charlie XCX and Lady Gaga stopped by to cavort with hundreds of revelers, including those with disabilities who'd previously been shut out of nightlife culture. Accessibility's been a gap in the industry. It was not in the forefront until we were all forced to be online. Serena, a co-founder of Club Quarantine, says, "But while some events move smoothly to the virtual world, other weightier ones, like religious ceremonies and funerals, proved more challenging. When Estelle Kaufman, 92, died in San Antonio in July, her grandson Brad and their Jewish temple organized a Zoom memorial service. The service went off without a technical hitch. Family and friends from around the country tuned in, reminisced, and shared their pain. But Kaufman says their emotions were somewhat dulled, the catharsis shallow. It seemed hard for some people to get out what they wanted to say because of the box they were locked in, he says. Zoom's greatest strength, its accessibility, allowed it to be used in a seemingly unlimited variety of ways. But the company's focus on ease of use soon became its greatest vulnerability. This is the Silicon Valley way. Get to market as fast as you can. Make it super user-friendly. And security is an afterthought, says Patrick Wardle, a security research at the software company Jamf. There are ways that a new Zoom reality could break down long-standing norms. Zoom offers the potential to reset hierarchical workplace dynamics. When everyone's on the same screen, there's no corner office. It cuts down on needless business flights. Studies have shown how increased flexibility positively impacts women in the workplace, particularly mothers with newborns. Whether or not Zoom ushers in a more equitable future, there are few who will be able to forget the first year spent on the platform. The McCabes, healthy and at home, are looking forward to showing Emberly Ann the Zoom video of her birth 10 years from now. To live in this world, we do with the tech we have. We got really lucky. Roxanne says, Zoom was not what we imagined for the year, but it's the best we had, and it held us together, one flickering call at a time. This article was slightly abbreviated and included reporting by Charlie Campbell in Shanghai, Billy Perigo in London, and the author of the byline, Andrew R. Chow. "2020, the year in quotes. The president is guilty of an appalling abuse of public trust." Mitt Romney, Senator, Republican, Utah. In a February 5 speech confirming he would vote to convict President Donald Trump on one of two charges of impeachment brought by the House on an otherwise party-line vote. Trump was acquitted in the Senate on both charges that day. "My most fervent wish is that I will not be replaced until a new president is installed," Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the late Supreme Court Justice, to her granddaughter, Clara Spera, shortly before her death, September 18. "It is with a heavy heart and a sense of deep gratitude to have ever been in his presence that I have to reckon with the fact that Chad is an ancestor now." Ryan Coogler, director, memorializing Chadwick Boseman after the actor's August 28 death. "For all those people finding it difficult, the sun will shine on you again, and the clouds will go away." Captain Tom Moore, British centenarian and World War II veteran who raised more than $44 million for the UK's National Health Service by walking 100 laps of his garden this past spring, finishing April 16. "Georgia's calls for help were ignored. Please listen to the call I'm making to you now." Philonise Floyd, in a speech to Congress June 10, asking lawmakers to hold law enforcement accountable for instances of police brutality and misconduct following the killing of his brother, George Floyd. "The great nation of Iran will take revenge for this heinous crime." Hassan Rouhani, president of Iran, tweeting January 3, after the killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in a targeted U.S. drone strike. "If she were here now, she would say that the fight is far from over." Donna Stevens, wife of Supreme Court plaintiff Amy Stevens, who died a month before the court's historic ruling June 15 that the 1964 Civil Rights Act protects LGBT employees from discrimination based on sex. "This is the first time, at least in my lifetime here, that people are saying enough is enough." Fayekemi Abudu, activist, in an October 19 interview with Time, as End SARS protests against police brutality spread across Nigeria. I've compared it to being touched by a Dementor in a Harry Potter novel. You feel like life is leaving you. By Alexei Navalny, Russian opposition leader, on being poisoned August 20 in an allegedly Kremlin-linked assassination attempt. I cannot express how little I care that you hate the photos, how little I care that it is something you would not have done. From Chrissy Teigen, in an October 27 essay detailing her decision to document her miscarriage on social media. I turned to my husband and I told him, I'm safe. Brian De Los Santos, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA recipient, in a June 18 interview with Time, after a Supreme Court ruling blocked the Trump administration from ending the program. And one more quote here. The heroism of these people is truly admirable, but doesn't it simply underline the singular failure of governments to protect the lives of their citizens? By Valerie Zandona, Athens, Greece. On the April 20, Heroes of the Frontline special report on those who risk their lives during the COVID-19 pandemic. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. The number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.